Well, you can't talk about agriculture unless you talk about the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And one agency in particular is at the center of a lot of the missions in serving farmers, and that is the Farm Services Administration. And FSA serves all farmers, ranchers, agriculture partners by delivering effective, efficient agriculture programs that are ultimately to benefit all Americans. And, boy, it's my pleasure to have somebody that's right in the center of all of it right now, the administrator of the Farm Services Administration, Val Dulcini. Val, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Roger, it's a pleasure to be with you. Good to be on your air today.
Well, you know, I tell you, this is an interesting time because we are in a transition period. I mean, I think you have been with an administration that is changing of the guard now, and a new administration will be coming in this coming year. So I think it's a good time for us to kind of pause and talk about what actually is done by an agency like yours to service agriculture. What are some of the range of the programs that you're involved with? And then I think, Val, I want to talk a little bit more kind of your own perspectives and your experiences and thoughts about the future. But maybe
absolutely.
Just, go ahead. I was going to say, just to get started, Val, can you give me, is there such a thing as an elevator speech for the for what happens with Farm Services Administration?
Absolutely. I'll give you an elevator speech for FSA. We are among, I think, probably the least well-known but most important agencies in the federal government in that we provide financial services and tools to the nation's farmers and ranchers through a variety of different mechanisms. Most folks who know about us know our Title I commodity support programs like ARC and PLC that cover lots of farmers in the Midwest who grow commodity crops and in the Southeast as well, not as much in California, but there are certainly some out there. We provide disaster assistance to farmers and ranchers that have been hit hard by floods or fires or drought or other forms of natural disaster. We have robust conservation programs that administer about 24 million acres through our Conservation Reserve Program, and that leads to all sorts of important conservation and environmental benefits for the nation's working lands. And then the other side of the house, Roger, is a credit program that last year loaned about $6.3 billion worth of credit to farmers and ranchers that couldn't get commercial credit. So folks who may not have the best credit history or simply were ineligible in one form or another for commercial loans come to Farm Service Agency offices around the country, and we really have played an important role in making sure that the credit safety net is as robust and as strong as it can be. So there are lots of things that we do around the nation. We operate through a network of about 2,200 offices from Maine to California. There are 15,000 or so folks that call the Farm Service Agency home, and we're assisted in our work by about 7,500 or so farmer-elected county committee members. So these are county committees that work with those offices that I mentioned around the nation to help with appeals and make program-related outreach for us and hire local staff and do a variety of different things. That in itself, I think, keeps us as closely connected to our customers throughout rural America as we can be. So we do important work all over the country every day of the week.
Well, you threw a couple acronyms out there. I'm going to stop you when we hit these acronyms because I think we're so used to hearing those in Washington. But not everybody does know. I think you mentioned ARC and was it PLC?
That's right.
What are those?
Yeah, those were two new programs in the 2014 Farm Bill. ARC is the Agricultural Revenue Coverage Program, and that addresses revenue declines on a farm in a given county around the country. PLC is the Price Loss Coverage Program. So the Farm Bill also focused on prices for the 21 main commodities that are grown in the United States, and when those prices dropped below a certain formula established by the Farm Bill, payments under the PLC program kick in as well. Those replaced a couple of older programs in earlier farm bills that paid farmers whether prices were good or whether they were bad. These programs are a little more closely tied to actual market conditions.
Well, everybody talks about subsidies, And the subsidies largely were established back in the 30s, and then farm bills are passed. Is it every 5 years that a farm bill is passed?
That's right.
And they tinker with those programs over the years. The last one that you're talking about, that was a fairly significant change to these new programs. Isn't that right? I think you were explaining that people used to get checks from kind of regardless of how things are going, and now it's much more of an insurance type program. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right, Roger. This last farm bill passed in 2014, and it took a couple of extra years to get this bill passed, so we were anxiously awaiting it here at USDA, but there were lots of important political issues that the Congress was debating. But this bill really changed the philosophy of federal farm policy to one that's more risk management oriented, and it involves, creating programs that provide safety net assistance when prices truly decline, as they have in the last couple of years, rather than simply, spitting out a check every quarter, whether prices are good or whether they're not. And that, coupled with a more robust, crop insurance program and several other things, I think really did pretty dramatically change the way USDA administers farm programs around the nation.
Well, let's talk about that a minute. Say, for example, I raise corn. We could take any commodity. I'm hoping corn might be a good general kind of an example. How could I, as a farmer, enroll to take advantage of the protection from these programs?
Great question. We started a massive national education process about these new programs once the bill had been signed. And when President Obama signed the Farm Bill in February of 2014, we were on the ground 2 months later with our first big disaster program. But these commodity programs, if you're a corn grower or soybean grower or wheat, operate fairly simply. Many of the corn and soybean and wheat guys attended public meetings that we held beginning a couple of years ago, and we did about 5,000 of these meetings around the nation, and farmers in many cases attended not just one, but two or three, sometimes more, meetings to better understand the new programs. We worked with land-grant universities to develop some good web-based decision aids and ended up partnering with about 70 land-grants to do public outreach and help us hold meetings and help better explain these programs to the nation's farmers and ranchers. We ended up, over the course of about a year-long education process, ultimately signing up close to 1.8 million farmers for these new programs. And about a year after we'd started the public process, we began to make payments under ARC and PLC and some of the other Farm Bill programs. And just now, this last October, we've completed year two of those programs, and I think that the reviews are pretty good by and large. The payments have been substantial, but prices have also declined quite dramatically in the last couple of years as well. So these Farm Bill programs are working as Congress intended them to work, and I think that now there are probably no producers out there in the country who haven't heard from me or my colleagues at FSA at least once or twice or more about these programs and getting into a county office to sign up for them.
Yeah, so let me go back to this again, though. So if I go in and sign up for them in a county office, though, and any other insurance I buy, I have to actually pay something. I have to pay a premium. Does a farmer pay a premium to be able to be insured by this program?
No. A farmer doesn't pay anything to enroll in the ARC or PLC programs or several of the other programs that we administer, but they do have to be eligible, and so we're going to look at their adjusted gross income, and we're going to make sure that payment eligibility criteria are met. And for most farmers out there, that's not too tough to meet the criteria that we've established. And as I said, we signed up more farmers for these programs than had participated in prior Farm Bill programs, so we think that the outreach worked pretty well, too. These were brand-new programs, Roger, not just to the nation's farmers and ranchers, but to our employees as well, and so we also did considerable staff training over that year-long period and did a lot of face-to-face meetings around the country, and I traveled quite a bit to meet with our staff in the various states to make sure that they understood it and that they had the appropriate resources to deliver these programs. We were delivering, in some cases, 2 years of back benefits in one because the Farm Bill had been a bit delayed in getting to us, but we've gotten back on track now and have, we're back on a schedule. So I think that these have been really solid contributions to the ag safety net that really protects not just farmers and ranchers, but urban Americans who rely on the nation's farmers and ranchers for the food, fuel, and fiber that we all need in our society.
So if you signed up for this program, and really it doesn't cost you anything, so I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't sign up for the program,
mm-hmm.
but if you sign up for the program and say the your break-even price you're thinking about is $2 a unit, say $2 a bushel or whatever mm-hmm. amount, mm-hmm. and the price comes in at $1.50, do they get like the difference between some sort of a target price that has been established and what the actual market is, so that that makes up the shortfall because the market was depressed?
Yes, they don't quite get the difference, but there is a rather complex, as you can imagine, formula that the Congress designed in the Farm Bill, and we use that to determine what level of payments they would be eligible for. Like with most of our programs, these are not programs designed to make someone 100% whole. You know, if you sell your commodities at $2 per unit and the price is only $1.50, you know, we're not going to make you whole in that we're not going to provide 50 cents on, you know, whatever the margin might be. But they are designed to make sure that there is a safety net so that if the prices continue to decline, that it doesn't pull an entire industry down with it. You know, what we're trying to do with our safety net programs these days, not unlike the original thought behind many of the New Deal programs in the late 30s, is to ensure that farmers and ranchers who arguably have more risk associated with their business are adequately protected, whether it's natural disasters or precipitous price declines or foreign competition that's challenged certain industries like cotton these days and other things. We really want to make sure that the safety net is still there for our farmers and ranchers, and that it does truly provide the protections that I think we as Americans all enjoy.
Well, what will be the simple answer to how you determine where that target price is? I say a target, and I think that's another word from another farm program. But mm-hmm. if you're going to use, say, a given commodity that they're going to sign up for one of these programs, who decides or how do they decide that this is a reasonable amount? This is the base. This is the baseline, and anything below it is subject to potential reimbursement.
Right.
Payment?
You know, those are mostly designed by the Congress. So the 2014 Farm Bill contained reference prices, I think they called them, for all of those 21 commodities in the PLC program, and an equally complicated formula for ARC payments as well. And all of those were designed by the Congress. And then when we got the bill, we had to figure out, you know, how to turn that formula into a program that works in 2,124 locations
wow.
from Maine to California.
You might know this off the top of your head, then. What would have been the price used for corn, for example, because the biggest commodity, I would imagine?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head. I know I have a lot of numbers in my head, Roger, but that's not
right.
One of them.
That's all right. But anyway, I think that, well, that's a really interesting point. And then, of course, a process devised by Congress, I'm sure they're going to get a lot of opinions on
Absolutely.
How they should arrive at those numbers, but then you just have to enforce it. And when this is the law and it was created and rolled out within the Farm Bill, is it another Farm Bill before it can be changed? Does this exist until it's replaced with a subsequent Farm Bill?
That's right. You know, and there has been some serious conversation in Washington over the last number of months about reopening the Farm Bill or opening it up a year or so early. And you know, I think we'll continue to see in 2017 a lot of talk about doing just that. I suspect that the House may move a little more rapidly than the Senate does, as is typically the case on big policy issues like this. But, you know, with the new administration coming to Washington and new appointees from the secretary on down, and the president-elect has about 4,000 positions to fill throughout the government, that will be an opportunity, I think, for a good, robust conversation about what new farm policy might look like and what some of the programs from the 2014 Farm Bill need tweaking or amending, and which of them have worked quite well. And I think in my travels around the nation and I've been out of 49 states with number 50 on the horizon. You know, there's a lot of satisfaction with what this bill has produced for American farmers and ranchers in all of its various titles. There's certainly some things that need to be done. The dairy program probably is the program that needs the most tweaking, but there are other programs that have really served the nation quite well.
And it's got to be a big number. I mean, I'm sure this is going to be showing up when people have been talking about how they can save, you know, cost of government. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure this is a really big number for to run this program. If the Farm Bill ran its normal course, when would they normally be starting to work on the next Farm Bill?
They would probably begin that process in 2018 and hopefully have a bill enacted, you know, for the 2019 crop year. Mm-hmm. You know, this bill may come a year early. It's a complicated political dance to get a piece of major legislation passed in really any area, and certainly farm policy is no different from a lot of other significant domestic issues. This one was a couple of years delayed because there was quite a debate over whether the nutrition title should be separated from the bill and, you know, whether it should be a standalone piece of legislation. I think ultimately they decided that for a variety of good reasons, you needed to keep that nutrition title in with the Farm Bill where it has been historically. But that issue will likely come up again, and there may be other issues associated with, you know, budget savings here and there. My feeling, though, Roger, is that we really need to look at what a piece of legislation like this, and maybe Farm Bill isn't the right moniker for it. It's a jobs bill. It's a public lands bill. It's a research bill. It's a trade bill. You know, it's a safety net bill. It's a credit bill. It does a lot of different things, kind of like a Swiss Army knife. But whether or not we should be looking at really what American farmers and ranchers and rural citizens need to begin the conversation rather than saying, okay, we've got to cut X billions of dollars out of the federal budget. Let's look to the Farm Bill to do that. If we establish the needs and have a really good and honest conversation about what farm legislation or what this rural policy bill should look like, then that's probably a better way to craft a meaningful piece of legislation for all who are concerned, from urban foodies to you know, those who grow corn to those who rely on conservation or credit or any of the other titles in the bill.
Boy, there's so much to talk about. I think, just go back and say that you mentioned the nutrition programs, and then you're talking about, I think, like SNAP, which used mm-hmm. to be like food stamps, but
right.
all of those programs, which are, you know, which are huge, and they're complex, too. Mm-hmm. And I know in the past has always been the feeling combining the both kept everybody talking. So you just
right.
didn't have one group saying, oh, this is my concern largely in the cities or poor rural areas, and this is largely my concern with the farm. It kind of kept them all together, and that gets a broad area for attention. Val, I want to go back to one thing you were saying that would surprise a lot of people, and that is you said like there's 22 commodities. Most people have the image that the farm programs per se, what used to be referred to as subsidies, mm-hmm. were going to corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, rice, maybe sugar, though that's
sugar.
Always confusing what that sugar
yeah.
program is. But I mean, like
right.
a half dozen come to most yeah. people's mind, even if there isn't in agriculture. So it's a little surprising to them that you in fact say there are 22 commodities that are included in the program.
Well, you've ticked off, you know, the 7 or 8 or 9 major commodities, and certainly I think that's what most people associate these programs with. The balance are relatively minor. You know, they could be oil seeds, they could be a variety of different, you know, grain crops that don't really rise to, you know, the level of public interest. But they've been historically a part of what has made these farm programs, you know, work over the years. You know, what I think that the next Farm Bill will bring, you know, and the last one did to a certain degree, is a greater emphasis on specialty crop production. Mm-hmm. Certainly places like California, you know, the West Coast generally, Michigan, New England, and there are other places all around the nation that focus less on commodity crop production, so less on corn and beans, and more on fruits and vegetables and other things. And that's been, you know, what has been missing from, you know, the kind of support that we've offered at USDA to some of these other crops. Now, we've developed in the Obama administration, I think, a more robust toolbox for especially crop producers, whether it's low-cost crop insurance or access to disaster programs or access to microloans, things like that, that have been very popular and really have worked quite well. And I think that the next farm bill will probably represent the second generation of our support for fruit and vegetable production and specialty crop production in general.
Sorry.
Go ahead. No.
Oh, I was just going to say, this is making me think of a conversation I had on another podcast with Tamar Hespel, who I'm sure you read the Washington Post.
I sure do, yeah.
And she writes occasionally in the Washington Post. She was making out the point, she just wished there'd come a time that all these products would qualify, not just in your, you've identified 20-some, but you've also mentioned, you know, you're from California.
Right.
And out here, what do we got? Over 300 different products that are food products that are...
Close to 400.
Is that right? That's 400.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that a realistic expectation that a program could be designed that touches, you know, the 400? Because, again, some states, especially California, we have hardly any corn to speak of. There's some, but not soybeans and not those traditional commodity row crops. We're growing all these other specialty crops, they call them.
That's right, Roger. You know, I've seen in my years in Washington, in this position, the big tent of American agriculture. And I think that there's a lot of room in that tent for incorporating fruit and vegetable production into some of the USDA programs that, you know, we're able to implement on behalf of traditional production agriculture commodity operations like those that you'd see in the Midwest or in the Southeast. I think that it's going to be important as we enter into a new conversation about what the next farm bill will look like to make sure that, you know, some of those programs that I mentioned are able to really continue to support, you know, the men and women in California, for example. It could be a returning veteran. It could be a woman farmer. It could be a farm worker turned farm owner on the Central Coast. You know, it could be any number of folks who've been on the outside looking in, so to speak, historically, and now want to be able to go into their USDA office and say, hey, I'd like some support too. We've really been able to open the doors more widely to farmers like that over the last 8 or 9 years, but I think that we really need to continue to, you know, redouble those efforts, because that's what consumers around the nation want. You know, they want to be able to know that their tax dollars are supporting big commodity operations, but at the same time are able to support the guy that markets his commodities at a local farmer's market or through a CSA or maybe the restaurant down the street. We can really do more if, you know, we're able to continue to use those tools, and that's, and we find those tools really in the farm bill.
Well, that reminds me. I mean, you actually have taken the lead on a lot of programs going out into non-traditional support. I mean, you have programs that are helping beginning farmers. You're helping small farmers. You even have programs that are helping urban agriculture and supporting and promoting farmers markets. And
that's right.
Did all of that mandate to do as much of this as you're doing, did that flow directly from the previous farm bill, or was some of that able to be initiatives of the current administration to get these programs going?
It was really a combination, I think, because when Secretary Vilsack came to his position in 2009, almost 8 years ago now, I think his inclination and direction to department leaders like myself was to make sure we were opening the doors as widely as we could, and that we had, you know, a welcome sign out for everybody in American agriculture, not just the folks that had been served so well over the years. And, you know, I use the microloan as probably my favorite example of a real game changer when it comes to our USDA programs. We started that program in January of 2013 and have since made about 25,000 of these loans of $50,000 or less since then to operations all over the country. And it has been a tremendous game changer in every community where we've been able to make a successful microloan. And I'm going to go next month to Brooklyn, where we've just closed on 9 of these microloans for an urban agriculture operation there in the heart of Brooklyn. And, you know, that's a great example of, you know, work that we can do in Detroit and Los Angeles and Chicago and other great cities in this country. So, you know, we can continue to serve our traditional customers very effectively, probably always will. But my view as administrator of the agency, and I think Secretary Vilsack's philosophy has been, let's try and serve everyone else as well, and we've been really able to do that.
Would it be a good guess on my part that that's not something we can be certain of going forward? Is it that the next administration may not have the priorities in this area, and since it's not clear-cut in the Farm Bill itself, that mm-hmm. those might not have as much support in the near term?
You know, I don't know that I'd go that far, Roger, because frankly, I think we've been able to demonstrate to some skeptics around the country, and frankly, they include members of both parties probably, you know, that these are programs worth continuing to invest in, and that undoing the efforts to broaden USDA's reach into urban America, for example, or with beginning farmers and ranchers, or developing a really worthwhile set of tools for returning veterans. I think all of those issues, frankly, are above partisan politics now and have demonstrated that they're successful and have demonstrated, you know, that there is a good business case for continuing to make investments like that into our farmers and ranchers around the nation. As you well know, the average age of the American farmer is about 60 now, and we want to do everything that we can as a nation, I think, to make sure that we're investing in the next generation of farmers and ranchers, and part of it is a program like the one I described, and part of it is making sure that those 2,200 offices can serve not only the guy that grows corn and has for 30 or 40 years, but maybe his son or daughter who might have a slightly different take on what it means to be a farmer in the 21st century and, you know, get a microloan to that young man or woman, work with the other agencies to maybe develop some conservation tools, to do a variety of things to, you know, set that man or woman up for success as a business person, because that's ultimately the, you know, the way to make an operation sustainable is not just the environmental aspect, but truly the economic aspect as well. And I think that we've demonstrated to the incoming administration, as well as hopefully to future administrations down the road, that this is definitely an investment worth making.
So if I'm, say, I've got 10 acres on the outskirts of Muncie, Indiana, and I'm going to be in mm-hmm. the food hub, and I'm going to raise some of my own vegetables and maybe put them into a salsa or something that I'm also mm-hmm. selling to local farmers. Can I go to the local FSA office and perhaps sign up and qualify for a microloan?
Absolutely, and it doesn't stop there, Roger. You might be able to also get some low-cost crop insurance for those tomatoes that you're going to grow for your salsa. You might want to do it during the cooler months. So we'll walk down the hall and introduce you to the conservation agency, and they can set you up with a grant that potentially would help you build a hoop house and, you know, gain a few more growing months out of the weather there. I can make an introduction for you at the Agricultural Marketing Service that might have some farm-to-school programs, or might have a farmer's market grant that they can make for you, or might help you with, you know, developing a better business model for other credit that you might need. Certainly, it could end at the microloan, but the wonderful thing about this unique footprint that USDA has around the country, and certainly in rural America, is that there are lots of different USDA agencies that can all offer a little piece to what will hopefully be building a really successful operation for you.
So if you say, if I'm going to get a microloan for $50,000, now since it is a loan, do you have to pay it back? And what happens if you don't, if you're not able to pay it back?
Well, absolutely. You know, as a loan, we want to see that loan repaid. You know, it enables me then to go out and make loans to the next farmer down the road if I have a good, healthy portfolio. And I would say that our default rate is quite low. You know, it's within acceptable industry standards. So most of the loans we make, whether they're small microloans or large ownership, land ownership loans, you know, most every one of those is repaid. If you're not able to repay it, you know, we really want to work with you on whatever servicing or restructuring of that obligation might be required to get you into a position where you can repay it. You know, and most of the time we have taken enough time at the front end of the relationship to ascertain whether, you know, you've got an operation that really pencils out at the end of the day and whether you've got something that you know, will allow you to make a profit as well as make your obligation, you know, make your payments to the Farm Service Agency. Sometimes the best answer we can give a young man or woman or a more experienced farmer coming into our offices is to say, you know, you're not quite ready yet. You're not quite ready to take on a $50,000 federal loan or a loan of a smaller amount or a larger amount for that matter. But this is how we want to work with you to get you to the point where you've got a little bit more economic wherewithal in your operation.
But you're going to be a friendlier spot for them to visit. I mean, you would assume that, that the first thing is that they have a need and they don't have the money. So that's the first thing about them. And then the next thing is that they maybe don't think that their regular bank is going to look, you know, at this as an attractive loan. So you're filling in a space, even though you might sometimes say no or do a little bit more work, you're filling in a space that nobody else is filling. You're not taking business away from a bank because they're not rushing to fund this kind of thing.
You've got that right. You know, there are programs that we offer where we'll partner with a bank and, you know, guarantee a loan that they may make. But for the majority of the loans that we're making, we're doing that because that farmer or rancher couldn't get a loan through a commercial bank or through a local, you know, ag credit bank. So we're taking a flyer, really, on folks that, you know, may not have as much experience or may not have as solid a credit history as others do. And, you know, ag lending is a tough market these days. I think that there are lots of banks that have, you know, retrenched somewhat and have pulled out of certain agricultural areas because they just don't want to entertain that kind of risk. And, you know, Farm Service Agency offices have always been there and will presumably always be there for rural Americans. And we've made a real difference just in this last fiscal year alone, but over the course of our time in rural America.
I think that there's so many areas to cover, Val, but one of them I want to hit on at least briefly before we wrap up is in the conservation area, because you're able to become engaged to be able to see that conservation improvements are made. Could you give me a kind of the 30,000 foot level view of that area of your assignment?
Absolutely, and that's a really important part of what Farm Service Agency offices do all over the nation. For 30 years now, we've administered the Conservation Reserve Program, which was originally designed to provide a bit of an economic incentive for farmers who were farming on environmentally sensitive lands, could be highly erodible lands in the upper Midwest or lands with wetlands on them. The program has evolved over time to become much more than that, and really now it's a program that has protected air and water quality, it's prevented the erosion of billions of tons of topsoil, it's protected over 170,000 miles of creeks and streams, it's created habitat for upland game birds and small mammals, and it's done a variety of different things in really almost every state in the union these days. So while it still continues to provide an economic incentive for farmers to enroll lands, you receive a small rental payment for a 10-year contract typically, it's had enormous environmental benefits that I think have benefited all Americans. And so CRP is going to be one of those programs I think that the Congress looks at quite closely as they get into, you know, the nitty-gritty of farm bill negotiations in the next couple of years. And there's a lot of support for CRP and the programs that we've developed since then, creating pollinator habitat, for example, working with states more closely to create regional approaches to things like Chesapeake Bay water quality issues or Mississippi Delta water quality issues. We're able to tackle things now on a regional basis and work where possible with states and with other federal agencies to do right by the land.
Well, Val, what an exciting area. You must have some mixed feelings about approaching a transition here. I mean, you knew going into this job that it wouldn't last forever,
right.
And somebody else is going to be in your desk before next year is over with. I don't know how
That's
soon
right.
that will happen, but somebody else is coming in. But I'm curious. I mean, give us a glimpse of what you're going to be missing. I mean, what have you appreciated most about your time as being the administrator for FSA?
You know, it's been a wonderful privilege. I'll start with that. It's been just a tremendous personal and professional honor to lead this agency over the last couple of years, and prior to that, to lead the agency's efforts in California. And so I think I'll start by saying I'll miss, you know, the people of the Farm Service Agency, all 15,000 or so around the country. And while I haven't shaken every hand, I've certainly seen most of my staff in just about all of the states now. And I know from firsthand experience how important the work that we do is for the nation's farmers and ranchers. And that's the second group that I'll really miss working with on a daily basis. Every time I go out to the field, I visit my staff in the county offices, and then also get out to farms or ranches and really talk with our customers about how our programs are working and how I can take good programs and make them great programs, and what I can take back to the policy conversations here in the halls of USDA and in my meetings with the Secretary and with members of Congress and with others. So I think just being at the heart of lots of important conversations and decisions and the development of a lot of really critical policy for the nation is something that I'll truly miss. And I hope to continue to be involved as this next farm bill fleshes itself out a little bit more, and I'm certain that I'll stay close to the issues. But it's also one of the things I've really enjoyed, Roger, is just making government work. You know, I think that these days a lot of people feel disconnected from their federal government, and for good reason in many cases. And we're able to, at the Farm Service Agency, reconnect people with the government that is there to serve them through our programs, through our physical presence, through the relationships that we've developed over the counter for many, many years in a lot of instances. And so being able to demonstrate to folks that, you know, I'm an effective and conscientious steward of their tax dollars, and that I'm taking complicated federal programs and turning them into meaningful assistance for farmers and ranchers all over this great nation. It's been, like I say, a true honor to be here, and I will miss a lot of things about it, and I think it's the people and the programs that we administer, and knowing what positive impact we're having is going to be at the top of the list.
Well, you've been all over the country. I think at the beginning of this conversation, you said you've been in 49 states, and you're going to close in on the 50th.
Yep.
I've been in 48 states on agriculture matters, and I'm missing one of those. I'm missing is in Alaska, and you recently mm-hmm. were up there. I thought you might just share. They have an entirely different agriculture than what I'm used to, and you. It strikes me when I look at when you get out to areas like this, you're helping them explore some non-traditional ways of mm-hmm. of how they could participate in the program. I wonder if you might just give us a quick example of some of what you ran into up in Alaska, and that is not what we would expect in many of the other states involved in agriculture.
Absolutely. You know, that was a fascinating trip, and it's one that I'd wanted to take for a long time, just as an American, to get up to, you know, sort of the last frontier, as it's known. Alaska imports about 95% of the food that's consumed in that state for obvious reasons. Obviously, its location is remote, really, to anything, and so while they rely a lot on what's grown in the lower 48 and elsewhere, they've developed some very innovative ways to approach food production right there in Alaska. And so while I visited an 8,000-acre grain operation in the central part of the state and a 500-head buffalo ranch near Delta Junction, I also went above the Arctic Circle, where they're growing greens in trucking and shipping containers using hydroponic irrigation and LED lights. And these are villages, Roger, where the poverty is dramatic and it's pervasive. And to be able to not have to rely on greens imported, you know, on two monthly ships from Seattle, and instead be able to grow those in Kotzebue, right there, makes an enormous difference. And then you're creating a culture of cultivation up there. And so I had some very interesting conversations with local food advocates who were very interested in working with some of the villages above the Arctic Circle and in Alaska's interior to really create more of a culture of cultivation rather than simply relying on what's brought in by ship or by plane. So Alaska has a long way to go, that's for sure, and I think that they'll always have to rely on a lot of imports to meet the needs of their population. But there's also, I'm glad to report, a real, you know, healthy culture around farming and ranching, and whether it was in the Palmer area, which is outside of Anchorage, where there's a vibrant local and regional food community, or the central part of the state, where you get to see some sort of traditional, you know, grain operations like you'd see in the Midwest, or venturing above the Arctic Circle to see these new approaches to, you know, the challenging issues of climate and climate change. And, you know, it was a wonderful eye-opener, and there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for USDA to play a helpful role, working with the state and working with individuals up there. And, you know, in many respects, I see that all across the country. There are lots of opportunities for USDA to play a helpful role in developing local and regional food conversations, whether it's my agency or some of the other agencies here at the department. I think we've done a great job over the last 8 years, and I really hope that the new team coming in decides that it's valuable to keep those conversations going and to keep the investments that we're making in places like Kotzebue, Alaska, vibrant and up to date and very active, because there's a real demand, I think, on the part of Americans, whether they're rural or urban, for a federal food policy slash farm policy that works for everybody. And we've begun to do that here in the Obama administration, and I sure hope that it continues.
Well, I also hope that whoever follows you in this job follows your lead in getting out, and I think also taking the lead in having a federal program that's not just one size fits all, that shows
right.
some flexibility and some sensitivity to different needs, whether it's in Brooklyn or whether it's above the Arctic Circle. I mean, it's that's quite an undertaking. And that I want to lead to the kind of a wrap-up. So if people are listening to this, certainly I'm sure they can go to the USDA website and find a lot of information. But I'm curious, Val, how about at the local level? You say you've got 15,000 employees.
Mm-hmm.
Is that nearly every county in the United States has an office?
I would say nearly every rural county does. You know, we have about 2,200 county offices from Maine to California, and chances are good that if you live in rural America, there's a USDA service center in your neighborhood. You can find us at fsa.usda.gov, or you can just start with the department's homepage, usda.gov, or you can follow me on Facebook if you want and take a look at some of the places that I've been to and, you know, the conversations that I've had around the country to further, you know, the discussion of local and regional food needs and traditional production agriculture and the like. Or you can just look at the white pages in your phone book and find USDA under the government listings there. Lots of ways to find us, and whether it's USDA is what you ultimately will need, or maybe a relationship with Cooperative Extension or your State Department of Food and Agriculture. There are lots of good resources out there for folks who want to learn more.
So they could look up Farm Services Agency and see, and then plug in where their address is and find out what's the closest office to them?
That's right. Once they get to the FSA homepage, they can look at the various state pages that are featured on that front page there and figure out if I'm in California and live in Fresno, where the office is in Fresno County. And that's true all over the nation. I think we're pretty easy to find.
And they can call them up, or can they just walk in and say, I heard this guy talking about a $50,000 micro loan. And
I want to sign up.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I think that for some it's better to have that conversation face-to-face, because you can ask more questions of the staff there. You know, some want to learn more about programs like the microloan program online before they have the face-to-face or the phone conversation. But, you know, in nearly every instance that I've been out into the field, my colleagues are really looking forward to and are great resources for the kinds of conversations that people are having all over the nation these days about how to create a vibrant agricultural, you know, community in their home state.
Well, I think that's exciting. And plus, I think that we're talking about people that might have run into a lot of rejection up to now. They've gone to the bank, they don't want to talk to them. They call somebody and they say, do you have an appointment? Or, you know, and
right.
they don't. And if, in fact, this is an office that's intent on helping and help them identify needs, like you described earlier, of saying we can walk them down the hall and tell them how they can get a grant for this hoop house, and we can
right.
we can say, why don't you think of this? And I think a lot of people aren't used to that anymore. And if they could feel that way with a federal office that's local, that's really trying to help them solve their problems, it'd be very, very helpful.
Roger, I think that's the name of the game. You know, we're at the end of the day in the customer service business, and so I want to make sure that whether you've been working with our offices for 30 or 40 or 50 years or have a great idea and you're brand new to agriculture, that there is a place for you to find information and develop relationships with folks that really want to help and really want to make sure that they're doing everything they can to expand opportunity and to build your version of the American dream. I mean, that's, I think, the beauty of the programs that we administer is every day we're investing in somebody's dreams, whether we're helping them recover from disasters or expand their farm or buy new land or develop a conservation model that works or any number of things. You know, all of it comes down to expanding opportunity and helping to revitalize rural economies around the nation, and I think we do that very well.
I think you do it very well, too, and I think that you would make Abraham Lincoln proud for having created the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and you and the agency walk the talk, and I think now as we're approaching kind of the end of this job for you, we want to thank you for your own public service. I think we
thank you.
In agriculture and actually beyond just the people that are production agriculture, but people that eat are fortunate to have people like you that take the time and make the commitment to try to make government work and solve problems. And thank you for what you've contributed. It's appreciated.
Well, I really appreciate that. And, you know, it's certainly a team effort here at the department and throughout the country. We've got a lot of great people who are very public-minded. And, you know, I'm fond of saying that when people of goodwill come together towards a common purpose, great things can and do happen. And I see that every day of the week all across this great nation.
Well, thanks again. Best of luck.
Thank you, Roger.